Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Amy Eddings in for Brian Lehrer, who's on vacation for the rest of the week. And speaking of vacations, as the weather warms, thousands of New Yorkers will flee the city and head toward the Hamptons, zipping along Route 27 or the Long Island Railroad. Most will pay little attention to the towns along the way as they blur past their windows. But if they were to spend time in the town of Shirley, located about 65 miles east of New York City, they would discover a working-class community that has struggled to define itself. Close-knit, yet dependent on outsiders and their tourism dollars. Blessed with a beautiful public beach, but unlike the Hamptons, known as a welfare haven. The former town of flowers, overshadowed by a federal nuclear laboratory that has dumped cancer-causing chemicals into the town's water table for decades. Kelly McMasters grew up in Shirley, and her new book is sort of a half-memoir, half-investigative reporting piece, mixing stories of her childhood with her drive to find out more about the effect of the mysterious Brookhaven National Lab on the town. It's called Welcome to Shirley, a memoir from an atomic town, and it's out now from Public Affairs Books. And welcome, Kelly McMasters. I almost said welcome, Shirley, here in the studio to WNYC. Tell me about Shirley. Where exactly is it? And is it reasonable for me to have characterized it as sort of a Long Island flyover zone, helicopter flyover zone?
I think that's a perfect way to categorize it. I think most people know it as the place to switch between the Sunrise and Long Island Expressway on their way to the Hamptons. Sometimes people might stop in for a food break or cheap gas, but otherwise most people just keep going right on.
And we put a link to a map of Shirley on our website. Go to WNYC.org and click on The Brian Lehrer Show. You spend a fair amount of time in the book talking about the origins of the town. How was it planned by a man named Walter T. Shirley, or as you speak of him in the book, Walter T.? Has that Levittown-like aspect of its history affected its character?
It has, and it's interesting. It took a few years of living there to understand that the houses, the structures that were on my block, were repeated over and over on different blocks, and it was very similar in that the cost-effective way of building houses where you have a concrete slab and then manufactured series homes, that is the similarities between Levittown and Shirley. Where it differed was that Walter T. he came from a vaudeville background. He wanted to be a performer, and he sort of fell into real estate after he failed at his first love. And so he was much more interested in making the big bucks, and he actually never lived in Shirley and never had experience in community building. So to this day, there's no Main Street in Shirley. Mm-hmm. And unlike Levittown, which did focus on, you know, town circles or town squares and really structuring the city, the little towns around centers where people can congregate, Shirley doesn't have any of that.
Right. Sounds like my hometown of Brunswick, Ohio. There's no town center.
Yes.
It's a sprawl.
There's no there there.
There's no there there. Exactly. And he sounded like he was a bit of a charlatan. He made these real estate deals with people based on these glossy brochures. Mm-hmm. and people were signing contracts in his office in Manhattan and didn't see the property at all.
Exactly. It was very Italian based. You know, a lot of fruit sellers from Brooklyn. You know, kind of the promise of a seaside getaway for the lower or middle class. And most people just saw this. There's one example in the Massick Mirich's Shirley Library, and it's this really funny pamphlet with a mermaid, and it was called, he called it the Town of Flowers, and Walter T.'s shtick was that it was the town by the sea, and anybody that moved there, he came and brought them their first window box full of flowers. And so there was a lot of promise and a lot of glitz, but what people didn't realize was there's actually a sandbar that blocks the town from the actual ocean. And Walter T., coming from this vaudeville background where, you know, certain things are done in the back room, and he also had a lot of government experience by the time he got into Shirley, and he was running some mayoral campaigns and things like that. So he had some friends, and he thought, well, if I build a bridge, then the government, it was Long Island Seashore, so it's actually owned by the state or the county. And he thought, well, if I build them this really beautiful bridge, they'll just give it to me. And so a lot of the town was based on this promise of sort of the Atlantic City of Long Island. And this is pre-gambling Atlantic City, of course. But the idea of these resort hotels and restaurants and a beautiful boardwalk and places where people could work. And, of course, he did build this bridge with great fanfare. And, unfortunately, he went back to the county officials and said, what do you think?
Give me the beach.
Exactly. And they said, well, thanks so much for the bridge, but I don't think so. And so even to this day, I actually worked at the beach concession stand when I was a teenager there. And it is beautiful, but there's no resorts or fancy restaurants or anything. So that sort of fell by the wayside. And Walter T. ultimately was more interested in trying to collect celebrity friends. And so he sort of started to forget about the people of Shirley. His son took over. Walter T. died in 63. And from then on, I think he had to have known by the time of his death that Shirley was not going to be the town of flowers that he hoped it would.
The darker side of the story of Shirley crystallizes for you when you're in the fifth grade and there's a big controversy over the image of the town. Tell us about the campaign to change the town's name.
This is something that you really can't imagine, something that seems so normal when you're in the environment. And then it's only when you leave or have some distance and look back that you think, oh my gosh, that was so strange and unusual. And this is one of those moments. When I was in fifth grade, there was a move to, it was pretty clear that Shirley had a bad reputation. And people were trying to band together to change that. And this is a continual issue in Shirley where the people who live there are constantly trying to change things and work together.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. Yeah. I apologize. It has a bad reputation. And what was that reputation?
Mostly the reputation was, as you said in your introduction, the welfare haven.
And was it? Were there a lot of welfare recipients living there?
Yes, there were. It's.
And how'd that happen?
Well, basically, after the farmers' loans sort of crashed, that was a big way that people bought homes there. And so especially in the early 80s, when my family moved there, when we came, there was a huge amount of boarded up, vacant homes that basically looked really horrible. And as we know today, in terms of the mortgage crisis, when one home on the block is foreclosed on, and, you know, you see it in Shirley a lot right now in Mastic and Mastic Beach, which are the sort of sister towns. And when one house in a neighborhood has that bright yellow sticker slapped on the front that says bank owned, foreclosed, and there's no one living there, and the, you know, the windows are boarded and the grass starts getting high, then nobody else, if there's another house for sale on that block, nobody really wants to buy it. So it's a cycle. And as those loans kept crashing, that more and more of Shirley turned into this sort of last chance, desolate, almost ghost town, really. And often you would find, you know, as families were moving out, basically there were mattresses or living room sets or things left behind, and it just started looking even worse. And so it was blue collar to begin with, but then it slumped even further down. And between that and then, you know, you have this glittering Hamptons alongside, there's always been a contentious relationship there because we depend on one another for survival. You know, Shirley needs the Hamptons because it pays our bills. Mm-hmm. The Hamptons need Shirley because we're the folks who make
the
Hamptons run.
And
yeah.
The hamburgers. And
exactly.
So it has this shoddy reputation. Mm-hmm. And briefly about the campaign to change the names. What was the name change? They wanted
the name change. They tried to change Floyd Harbor.
Oh, Floyd Harbor.
And this was based on William Floyd, who did have a residence in the town. And he signed the Declaration of Independence for New York. And he's sort of this colonial patron saint that people constantly bring up. And basically a group formed It was called the Committee to Keep Shirley Shirley. And they came out with their slogan, which was very proud blue class. You know, we want to keep Shirley Shirley and we love it for these reasons. So that slogan was, where's da harbor?
Where's da harbor?
Yeah. And it was spelled D-A. And it sort of celebrated everything that I think was the reason some people wanted to change the name. And I think the idea was, well, if we change the name, it'll sort of be like, you know, cutting the albatross free. Mm. It'll give us a new start.
But it failed.
It failed. It actually, the...
Because of civic pride?
Well, it was a little bit, as it always is the case with Shirley, it was a bit complicated. It did go to a vote, and the Floyd Harbor people won, but the vote was boycotted by the Where's Da Harbor, by the Committee of to Keep Shirley Shirley. And so when it got to the U.S. Geographic Names Committee, who's the only place that can actually make a name change like that, they said, you know what, this vote is moot because there was a boycott involved, so we're not changing it. Mm. And you can still drive down the highway and see, you know, Floyd Harbor Pharmacy, Floyd Harbor. There's still this, and still to this day, people have been talking, well, maybe now we can change the name. So there is that hope is still alive.
A lot of the stigma associated with Shirley is connected to the Brookhaven National Laboratory and the environmental and health effects it had on your town. I want you to read a bit from your book, the section where you first start to realize just how big the effect the lab had on Shirley.
Okay. While I was growing up, the Brookhaven National Laboratory was a fixture of my imagination, as it was for the other kids in the neighborhood. Much like the proverbial monster in the basement, the lab obsessed us precisely because it was so close, and yet we had no access. We couldn't see the buildings or the scientists who populated them. The majority of the scientists lived on the North Shore or west of the laboratory, not in Shirley. The neighborhood fathers, like Jerry and Andrew, who spent their days there, refused to talk much about what their jobs actually entailed or what kind of work went on at the lab. Years later, I realized that this was not the result of some secrecy pledge they swore to on their first day of work, but more likely because they didn't actually know what was going on in those clandestine reactor buildings any more than we did. They were support staff, not scientists. Andrew had gone to pharmacy school and worked in the computer department, whereas Jerry, like most of our parents, had never gone to college at all and probably didn't remember the mechanics of fission from his high school physics lessons. Lacking any real knowledge, we created our own version of the Brookhaven Laboratory. In my mind, the lab's buildings were made of a transparent igloo-like substance, and the rooms inside were full of metallic file cabinets, clinking glass test tubes, and notebooks full of secret codes. Men and women in crisp white lab coats and plastic goggles coaxed new species of frogs and lizards out of mottled purple eggs. Others hovered over milky glass globes of light, whose kinked antennae sparked blue shots of electricity into the dim, silent air. And the lab-coated scientists ate crayon-colored pills for lunch that tasted like chicken cutlets and chocolate cake. After Jerry's cancer, my imaginary lab became a much darker place, a small, sinister pocket hiding in the pines.
That's Kelly McMasters, journalist and author of the book, the memoir, Welcome to Shirley. We're taking your calls. Are you from Shirley or Mastic or Mastic Bay? What do you think of Kelly McMasters' thoughts on your hometown? We also want to hear what you think of the Brookhaven Lab, which has had a huge effect on the town. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or send a comment to us at the Brian Lehrer Show page at WNYC.org. Kelly, was Jerry's cancer the first time you grew suspicious of the Brookhaven Lab?
It was. I was still a young child. His daughter, Tina, was my best friend. And he was really the neighborhood dad of you know, the area of the few blocks that we lived in. And that was mostly because he did have what was considered a coveted position, because the lab afforded him health insurance and security. Unlike a lot of the other fathers, you know, my dad and some of the other dads who worked either service jobs or construction, who were gone for long periods of time. So Jerry was always the one to come home and hang out with the kids after work, and he was always there for dinner and things like that. And when he got sick, it really had a profound effect on the neighborhood. And when we lost him, it was clear that He was my father's best friend, and as he was dying, he did talk about things that went on at the laboratory. He was a maintenance man, but not in the way where he was emptying waste paper baskets. He was, you know, handling waste, and there were, through the research I've done, there were pits dug during his tenure that I think it's very likely he had a part of, and these were
pits to put wastewater?
It was actually irradiated lab coats or the carcasses of animals that had been experimented on in the reactors and things like that. And when Superfund came in 1989 and started investigating, these pits were way too shallow and they were supposed to be segregated and they weren't. And there were just a lot of missteps. And Jerry did confess to my father that he thought that it had a lot to do, and the neighborhood did all sort of come to the same conclusion that this is his job was definitely related. And he would always joke when he first came home that, and this didn't hit me until after his death and really when I started working on the book, where he'd joke that he glowed in the dark and he would not, if he pulled into the driveway and the kids were out on the street, he wouldn't let us hug him. He would say, "Hey, I was green slimed at work," you know, from popular Nickelodeon television show at the time. And he would hold us back and say, "No, let me take a shower first. Let me change my clothes first. Then I can come out. Mm. Then we can touch each other."
Was the town aware of what was going on at Brookhaven? Did they know that there were nuclear experiments going on there?
It's really fascinating. As I went back and did more research, there's a class action lawsuit that's going on and has been going on for 10 years. And as I went back and talked to my parents, the neighborhood parents, it became pretty clear that not only did people not realize that there were reactors humming in the behind the Pine Barrens, but nobody really understood that there was this lawsuit and that there was this, you know, shadow kind of hanging over the town.
And what was the link between Brookhaven and the town? It was creating these pits. Mm-hmm. Was it had a wastewater treatment plant? Mm-hmm. Was this wastewater getting into the town's drinking water? And how did that happen?
Well, really, in the early 80s, when the Shoreham nuclear power plant was being built and tried to open and ultimately failed, a lot of activists came out and fought it and said nuclear power, nuclear reactors have no place on Long Island. Long Island's basically a giant sandbar, so the soil is very permeable. Things run through very quickly. And more than that, there's no evacuation route. If you're past a certain point, unless you have a rowboat, you're really not going anywhere. So a lot of the activists then, when the Shoreham discussion came about, they were very surprised to find actually there had been three reactors sitting there since the 1940s the entire time. But if you understand the visual, the lab sits in the center of the Pine Barrens, so they have that natural barrier. The Pine Barrens also acts as a recharge basin. It's one of the largest sole source drinking water aquifers in the country. It serves 3 million people. And so the lab is sitting in the center of this aquifer. And unfortunately, each of the three reactors leaked. And aside from the tritium that leaked, there are 31 contaminants that were released throughout. And there are...
These are radioactive elements?
There were 5 radioactive elements. And then there were other volatile organic compounds, PCBs, things like this. So chemical waste as well as radioactive waste. And right now, the first real sort of interaction happened when it was known that there were these underground sort of pools of VOCs, the volatile organic compounds, that had crossed the border and gone into the town. Shirley shares a border with the town, and it's all water on Long Island runs south and east. And so it's really the first in the line of fire. And
Shirley was drawing its drinking water from the aquifer?
Yes. At that time, Shirley was all on drinking water wells, so not municipal water. It was all You know, unless you had it tested yourself, there was nothing stopping. You had no idea it was in your water.
Wasn't Brookhaven removing these materials in its wastewater treatment plant?
They were trying to do that. And unfortunately, a lot of these chemicals, the leaks went for years without knowing that the leaks actually existed. And so it was these kinds of basically what was going on underground, you couldn't see and you didn't know. And so they actually, when the first plumes came, were discovered, they paid for the hookups for a large part of North Shirley to get onto municipal water, which actually is drawn from the same place. But at least then, you know, they can check for the different you know, chemicals that might be in the water.
We are taking your calls, especially if you are from Shirley, for Kelly McMasters, a journalist and author of Welcome to Shirley, a memoir of an atomic town. Ramon from Larchmont, you're on WNYC. And you grew up in Shirley?
I spent every summer in Shirley since 1959, I think until about the late 70s, when, because we were a working class family, we had my grandparents and three families. And when we were small, it was fine because we grew up and spent it from the last day of school to the first day of school. We were there all summer, and our fathers came out by train to see us on the weekends. And it was like heaven. But I would say one other thing. What's interesting in the description, I can't wait to get your book, but what was interesting in the description, when we were growing up, the big issue was the Long Island duckling. If you recall, Long Island ducks are famous as a brand. There were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of ducks being raised and then slaughtered in the estuaries that fed the Great South Bay, which she's been talking about, and Smith Point Park and the Smith Point Bridge and all that. And I had a cousin, who I still have, he's a couple of years older than me now, who sustained an illness. He got osteomyelitis, which is a bone disease that they thought was caused by all of the effluents from the ducks, but they could never prove it. And he was, he had to take out a piece of his bone, and he was in the hospital for 6 months.
Ramon, do you think it might have, his illness might have had a connection with Brookhaven Lab?
You know, I don't know. Our experience with Brookhaven Lab, and you know, he's 59 years old now, I'm 54, and we're all attorneys and accountants, and we were the first people in our families to go to college. But the Brookhaven Lab, for our purposes, when we were growing up, was a place you went to on an open Brookhaven Lab day, and they showed us all these different scientific things, and we got all...
Kelly's nodding in agreement here.
We got all excited about it, and I come from a pretty radical family, so my mother would say, you know, these people are doing these secret things, and they're probably killing us all. And, you know, she's 84 years old, and she's got more wisdom every day as I get older.
Ramon, thank you for your call. Kelly McMasters, I'd like to move on to the topic of the illnesses and cancer incidences in Shirley. The New York State Health Department's study of breast cancer between 1993 and 97 found Shirley had incidences 15 to 100% above the expected rate. You talk about that in the book. I recall studies of cancer clusters on Long Island. They came to no conclusions about whether they were being caused by environmental factors. Task Force Chair Roger Grimson, a biostatistician and an associate professor at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, concluded in a Newsday article at that time, there's no link between Brookhaven National Lab and cancer. What did you find?
Well, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because as I looked at the majority of these studies, including the largest, the Long Island Breast Cancer Study Project that went on for 10 years, what I found was almost across the board, they either left Shirley out, or it was more of an ecological rather than epidemiological study. And there was never a study that I found that I felt really spoke to the people of Shirley. For example, the Long Island Breast Cancer Study. They concluded that the risk factors were such that affluence, late childbearing, all of these things that really spoke to the high rates of breast cancer on Long Island. certainly didn't include my little working class town. And those, you know, affluence is obviously not part of my community. And
they were also just looking for DDT too, right?
Exactly.
They were very focused in what they were looking at as a link instead of being more expansive.
There was such hope with that study, and the activists really rallied around. And I think that the hope was that the activists worked really hard to look at the idea of maybe synergistic chemicals. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's not just DDT, but it's DDT and the chromium. Maybe it's not just, the tritium, but it's the tritium and the
PCBs.
Exactly. Right. And so I found that very... And the reason that this did turn into a hybrid with a memoir aspect, that was, I'm not a scientist, I'm not an epidemiologist, but I found this was the most honest way to get the true experience of living in that town and feeling over and over again that we were being overlooked and ignored. And this was really my version, my most scientific version of trying to tell the truth. And
Kelly McMasters is the author of Welcome to Shirley, a memoir from an atomic town. It's out now from Public Affairs Books. Thank you for coming into the studio.
Thank you so much.
We'll be hearing from our poet in residence in studio and from you on this, the last day of Poetry Month. Stay tuned.